whose circulation in the South is largely controlled by intermediaries or agencies. And that's largely the case except for Turkey. It doesn't mean there aren't agencies in Turkey, but it's not like in the other regions. And in fact, Gia Agapuri, in relation to Kurdistan, will be talking about the role of agents in particular. Next. A further aim is to precisely that the research seeks to contribute to a gendered sensitive understanding of the interaction between economic and sociocultural drivers of labor migrations in cities in the Kurdistan region, Erbil, in Lebanon, Beirut, Pakistan, Islamabad, and Turkey, Istanbul. We were supposed to do second cities, but COVID put an end to that. So we're also looking at gaining an understanding of the use of urban space by different categories of female migrants. And again, Ezgi will be exemplifying that in her presentation. Next. Now, having talked about the fact that we would argue that probably in relation to female migration, we have quite a complex set of reasons that lead to drivers of that migration. And one of the things we've been doing is to use the evidence from the OECD Social Institutions and Gender Index, or SIGI, which suggests that women's migration is particularly affected by socially discriminated institutions. And they categorize these types of discriminatory institutions into four. Family, which could be forced early marriage, household responsibility, restricted physical integrity, that would include violence against women, reproductive autonomy, restricted access to productive and financial resources, for example, employment, but also access to bank accounts, and restricted civil liberties, which would include freedom of movement, access to justice, and citizenship. Next. And I'll be coming back to that in a minute, as you'll see. So in terms of methodology, very rapidly, to say we did a literature review of gendered labor migration, especially in the global South. We did an analysis of the SIGI, which provided us with a framework, not only for understanding what the gender discriminatory institutions and the scores they were getting in different countries, but we actually incorporated that in our interviews to give us some kind of guiding framework to understand the kind of gender discrimination that females had experienced in the country of origin and as well in the country of destination. We did interviews which are not finished yet and have not been fully transcribed with migrant women with different educational levels and sectors, including not only South-South, but also, as we'll see, the very much understudied North-South. Next. Within the interviews with individuals, we included the life in the country of origin, the drivers of migration, their experiences in the country of destination, and their use of urban spaces, as well as the impact of COVID-19, because we started the interviews after COVID hit. So there we looked at the relationship, how did COVID affect their working lives? What were their relationships with others, both those they worked with and friends? The territorial entrapment, the inability to move from the country, the access to PPE and healthcare, and lastly, did they experience increased gender violence? Just also to say that COVID made accessing interviews difficult, and it changed our sample quite a lot because, and particularly with those working in domestic and care work, it was very, very difficult to engage with them. And then we've also done some interviews with INGOs and NGOs, and these have been mainly related to MDWs. Next. Now, in terms of the drivers of migration, in terms of some of the results, whilst Lebanon and Turkey have produced an extensive literature on gendered labor migration, largely on MDWs in the past 20 years, there really is hardly any research or publications in Kurdistan, Iraq, or Pakistan. So in this case, we are really entering into very novel territory, where we have very little information, either statistically or in terms of existing publications to which we can turn. What we also found in our empirical research, which you'll hear much more about from the other speakers, is that there is a complexity in combining gender discrimination and economic drivers, particularly in cases that we found in Turkey and Lebanon. but also in other country, in the other two cases, which were arising from experiences of domestic violence, LGBTQI discrimination at work, at home, and the public sphere, the total lack of rights for women in certain cases, the lack of respect for women working, and the inability also to get divorce, to get the husbands to agree to divorce in certain cases. Next. The other element, I think, overall, which it's worth bearing in mind, is that there's a stratification in the access to quality of work and residence rights, not just between the less skilled and the highly or more skilled, but also within each of the categories. So what Esty will also be talking about is that the educated from the global north are much less likely to be skilled. There's quite a lot of evidence in other countries that those from the global north are treated in a better manner than the skilled from other global south countries, where they're much more likely to be de-skilled. And we'll see that again, as I say, in the Turkish example. Amongst the lesser skilled, we also found considerable stratification. So it came out in the different countries that the Filipinas are well organized and well networked. In some cases, Filipino migrant women have set up their own recruitment agencies, or they perform a higher level of care work, such as being a nanny for children, or they've managed to move out of the domestic and care sector altogether. So we see here a stratification, which we'll also hear about in some of the later presentations. Next. So finally, I would like to ask, I think one of the things we want to ask ourselves, apart from saying we need to gain more knowledge from the global south, and in terms of the argument that we need to center our knowledge, because it also fits into a lot of the decolonization debates, I think we need to ask the question of how do we incorporate the insights and the empirical data from our studies in the global south and treat the global south on equal terms with the global north, because we can get many more insights from the global south, but still treat it as being subordinate to the global north. So what my suggestion is we take these insights and these empirical data and think about how does it fit into a broader analysis of gender, labor, migration, combining the diverse global circulations, whether they be in the global north, in the global south, whether they be south-south or north-south. So basically is that, and also of course to take into account the fact that as you hear, the professionals in our samples have been quite important. And it's something that's the reason for starting off with the next speaker, who's Esty Tunca from Kadiahas, whom I think Evelyn would have already introduced. And that's why Esty is going to start off with the area that we feel is being not just understudied, but the understudying of it, we would argue, exemplifies disregarding what's going on in the global south, where the skilled might be just called expatriates and they're really not taken very seriously, especially if they're female migrants. So over to Esty.
Okay. Thank you, Eleanor, for this wonderful presentation and introduction. So today I'm going to talk about one part of our project that we conducted in Turkey, Istanbul, which is about high-skilled female migrants. And Zeynep will continue with the domestic and care workers. So those are two basic dominant groups that we conducted interviews with. So in this presentation, this part of research discusses gendered experiences of migration and emplacement of high-skilled female migrants in Istanbul. And it examines hidden drivers and gendered processes of migration of high-skilled women from both northern and southern countries, and also their life experiences in home environment and work environment, and their spatial experiences in public spaces in Istanbul. And one of the significant points of this research is that it contributes to the recently growing analysis of north to south and south to south high-skilled female migration. And the other crucial point is urban mapping of use of public spaces, areas of mobility, and experiences of unpleasant behaviors of high-skilled female migrants in Istanbul which have led us to rethink and expand the concept of the right to the city in terms of migrant women's points of view. In this presentation, we focus on the analysis of 14 interviews with high-skilled professional women and 4 interviews with high-skilled women who experienced de-skilling and have become domestic and care workers in Istanbul. The majority of our participants are upper middle-income academics, teachers, coordinators, editors, translators, and NGO workers who are between 22-42 years old, mostly from North America, Europe, and Middle East, and have stayed in Istanbul between 2 to 15 years. 4 of our interviewees are low middle income domestic and care workers aged between 42-63, who migrated from former Soviet republics and have lived in Istanbul between 4 and 10 years. While half of them have full-time positions with work permits that provide them with social security and access to healthcare, others with part-time, daily, or temporary positions only have short-term residence permits. But a few of the interviews also have dual citizenships. Precarious working conditions in North America have emerged as the most obvious driver of migration of the first group of our interviewees. However, kinship ties, marriage migration, and lifestyle change are also significant reasons to move. Most don't have teaching experience and pedagogical formation. However, they use their advantage as native English speakers to become language teachers as the first and easiest way to enter the professional sector and establish their lives in Istanbul. They mostly got a teaching certificate and started to work in well-paid jobs at schools. They enjoy much higher living conditions than they could have in their home countries. They also build a new career and a better reputation. As an example of upward mobility, we think that this group should be also studied with a larger group of participants, because in the international migration literature, there are studies on migration and life experiences of native English language teachers, but this phenomenon is not yet recognized in Turkey. There are also chief copy editors, chief copy editors, coordinators, realtors. Some faced gender discriminative practices at their workplaces, since they have been perceived as hypersexual and easily taken. They were also belittled for being foreigners and told they couldn't understand Turkish culture or concept or Turkey. Some have stayed in their international communities, have not related with locals a lot. However, there are some exceptions who are married Turks and have kinship ties embedded in life and culture in Turkey. So you see the example, one example of an American realtor and the other example who are married to a religious Turkish guy and embedded in conservative culture. And most have bad experiences in public spaces or taxis, such as physical or verbal sexual harassment and robbery. All have restricted use of public spaces and haven't been highly mobile in the city. Most have created self-censoring dress codes and attitudes. Our interviewees pursuing their career, academic careers and job opportunities can be considered as a traveling group who have been on the move for their education. The extreme competitiveness in academia in North America and UK and the UK and the difficulty of finding full-time permanent positions have led many to seek employment in European, Middle Eastern and North African countries. We think that this driver, which hasn't been emphasized much in the literature of migration and gender studies, should be also investigated more comprehensively. the international validity of the training they received, their publications and competence in teaching in English have placed them in well-paid positions in the Turkish academy. Sorry. Most prefer to live in secular environments as well. However, they have been established stronger relations with locals in their home environments. However, some felt unwelcomed and couldn't maintain friendships. Lebanese and Armenian academics have ethnic communities and specific places to meet. Lebanese have been more open to socialize or live in religiously conservative areas since they found Istanbul more secure than Beirut in terms of sexual harassment. Most have been highly mobile in the city, although they have felt unsafe walking alone at night. All have dress codes as well, yet most have not experienced bad attitudes in public spaces or in public transportation. Although primary drivers of migration of this group, the third group, mostly consisting of Syrians, Iranians, and Lebanese, were mainly war, conflicts, and political pressure. It has been understood that gender inequalities, violence, and discrimination towards sexual identity that they experience as a woman in their home countries are the hidden drivers of their migration. This phenomenon needs to be explored in depth with many others from other southern countries and with a larger group of interviewees. Our interviewees have been working as translators, radio hosts, NGO workers, and web programmers in Istanbul, and they live in predominantly migrant, relatively conservative neighborhoods in the southwest of the city. But there are significant differences between those with religious or secular backgrounds. For example, Syrians having a religious background liked conservative areas, mostly stayed in their ethnic community, supporting each other. But others, particularly Iranians, didn't feel comfortable, even were disturbed in conservative environments. Some experienced racist, discriminative attitudes in their home environments. They have been actively using public spaces, particularly southwest seaside of the city. Most, however, have experienced, sexual harassment, stalking, and bad behaviors in public spaces or in public transportation. Most felt insecure and generated dress codes and self-censoring tactics in specific locations in Istanbul as well. Although there are many studies in the national literature on domestic and care workers, as well as on de-skilling, there are very few studies that address the experiences of highly skilled women from the former Soviet Union in Turkey from a gender perspective. De-skilling has mostly been studied for those who work in the tourism, entertainment, and agriculture sectors. The literature on migrant domestic workers, on the other hand, ignore the educational levels and skills of these women who survived upon the circular labor migration between the former Soviet countries and Turkey. We agree that one of the reasons for this is the assumption and illusion of that highly skilled women come only from countries of the global north. Most of the interviewees have hard working and living conditions and have low middle income. Majority of them are live-in workers who lived where they found a job in Istanbul. Therefore, most didn't have relations with locals and the neighborhood itself. All only have residence permits. Most experienced bad behaviors and troubles at their workplaces related to their salaries and workloads. And most couldn't have the chance to discover Istanbul due to both having economic difficulties and the need to have rest in their off days. they also have bad experiences in public spaces, such as verbal harassment and security controls. So thank you for listening to me, and I would like to share another link for this map that I showed you. Just spare me with a second. I'm going to show it to you and copy the link in the chat box that you can travel in Istanbul to see the narratives or to see the experiences of these high-skilled female migrants. So this is for their home environments. And when you click one of them, in some of them, there are some narratives that you can read. And there's also work environments and some experiences related to that. There is public access and mobility, the places that have they have been, and they're enjoying, they're eating, drinking, or they're meeting their friends. And experiences of sexual harassment. These are the quarters or neighborhoods that they had some sort of sexual harassment experiences. And there are also their narratives here. You can read them as well. And this is for unsafe, uncomfortable environments. And there are just two, there are many, but I just took two of them, thoughts in Istanbul, on Istanbul. So as I presented you in the beginning, this shows the participants, our participants from both the global north and global south. And as I said in the beginning, orange ones are Americans, blue ones are academics from both sides, and green ones are Syrians and Iranians, basically, and the purple ones are from the former Soviet Union. So I'm just going to share this map with you to examine more. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ezgi. I think Eleanor has dropped out for another second, but I'll just hand over straight to Kieran, who will speak next.
Thank you. I'll share my screen and then start the presentation. So continuing on, gender labor migration in Pakistan. To understand gender labor migration in Pakistan, we need to see the context of migration, labor market, and gender within Pakistan. Starting with migration, the history of migration in Pakistan goes back to even before the establishment of modern Pakistani state. So we have like people moving in and moving out of Pakistan. But recently and since 1970s, the focus has been on emigration. Mostly men from urban and rural areas, they go to Gulf countries or Europe and North American countries for work. Women in migration or gender has been, you can say there's no existence of migration as such, but it is changing recently as we see women moving to Gulf countries for work in nursing or as domestic carers. Otherwise, Pakistan is both a top country in emigration and immigration, mostly because of Afghan refugees. We see that there's influx of Afghan refugees. Given this context, again, there's no policy engagement or acknowledgement that migration is a huge policy or governance matter that should be addressed by the state. So it usually go unnoticed or unacknowledged. Then we have labor market. So Pakistani labor market consists of both formal and informal sectors. Formal sectors have like proper regulations. There are like timings, wages set and contract. But in informal sectors, there are no regulations as such, so no formal contracts, wages, or work time. So there's a lot of negotiation involved in informal sectors. And according to ILO reports, 73% of Pakistani labor market consists of informal sectors. So you can see it's a huge, you can say, economic marketplace. Again, there are no legal frameworks that could regulate informal structures. So we see that there is a higher risk of exploitation as well as negotiation, as well as job insecurity within these informal structures. Then gender in Pakistan is like, according to Global Gender Index, Pakistan is ranked 151 out of 153 countries, and there's low economic participation of women as well. So overall, in the context of gender, Pakistan is not a very, you can say, safe country for women. So given this context that there's migration history, but no government engagement or protection provided to these migrant groups coming into Pakistan, as well as the informal sector and economy that governs the society and gender index, we see that it's not one of the top favorable countries to move to Pakistan. And we see, and we will see how it impacts, or how despite all these, women come to Pakistan for work and how it impacts their experiences in Pakistan, both in work as well as social, social and other engagements. So our participants, we had participants from various different countries. You can see we had Filipinos, Afghans, Canadians, German, French, Ugandan, Tanzanian. So you can see there are like migrants from South countries as well as North countries. And mostly predominantly our participants work in teaching sector, which is more, you can say, formal. There are contracts, wages set and regularized by the government and institutions. Then we have NGO and nonprofit. Again, it's a very formal sector. Domestic care is a bit ambiguous because there are agreements between the government of Pakistan and the Philippines, but the negotiation about like pay and everything is not formalized. So usually they do come through an agency and governments are involved, but in terms of how they negotiate their pay, their experiences in Pakistan, it is mostly like governed very informally. And then we have like participants who are self-employed or work in small and medium businesses, and other consist of women working in customer care and other informal job market gaps. Other than these, we did identify various groups and sectors, but there is no data available, as well as we couldn't access these groups. For example, CPEC is a multi-million dollar agreement between Pakistan and China, and under this agreement, a lot of, you can say, Chinese highly skilled and experts come to Pakistan to work in construction and energy sectors. But again, these are very protected groups, so we don't know how many migrant women are there, Chinese migrant women, and what kind of experiences, social, economic, and migration experiences they face as migrant women in Pakistan. There's no official data available because of security and sensitivity. And there are sex workers in a major city in Pakistan, Karachi. Again, we couldn't get access to those. So again, there are groups that we don't know what their experience is like in Pakistan. So yeah. Sectors that we focused on are the top sector where majority of our participants work in. Teaching in our literature, we found that mostly Afghan or Hazara women, they were engaged in teaching within their communities. But when we did our research, we conducted interviews with highly skilled and qualified teachers and academics from various countries that come to Pakistan. They work in higher education as well as international schools. They are usually recruited, and their entire visa and contract is facilitated by the institution. So state is not involved. There are no policies to protect them or govern that how these will come to Pakistan and how their experiences would be here. So if you could see like these experiences that I have shared, generally, like for example, one of our participants, she came because of a contract between a Turkish university and one of the Pakistani universities. So even she is paid by her own university back home, like from Turkey. So she just here, she's here to teach, and she then decided to stay here in Pakistan. Then we have like other academics. They understand that Pakistan is a challenging country to be in. And as a foreigners, they don't really have protections and privileges despite their high qualification and experience. They go through like the same kind of trials and tribulations as another Pakistani academic. So as one of them shares that the challenges that she faced were not due to that she was a foreigner or a woman. Generally, the environment was not really you can say, conducive. So these are the experiences that they face. The other sector that is usually that goes unacknowledged in research reports and policymaking is like workers or like highly qualified women working in NGOs and nonprofit. Again, it's a very high paid and highly demand sector where a lot of women from both northern countries and south countries, they come to Pakistan. They are usually, you can say, they have the same status or protections granted to a diplomat, so they are treated as such. So there are a lot of perks and privileges to be working in NGOs or for the UN. As you can see that they feel whenever they go somewhere, even for work, they always have a security detail. And the kind of people they interact with, they're usually educated and are from a particular circle. So their experiences in Pakistan are generally, like you can say, positive, and they feel much more empowered. So you can see a distinction in how like women from different socioeconomic classes and professional backgrounds, they negotiate or experience working and living in Pakistan. Then we have domestic care workers. Again, it's regularized, but there is this ambiguity because it's considered a part of private sphere as well as public health. There is involvement of public as well because there is an agreement between the government of Pakistan and the Philippines government. So they have this agreement that there should be agencies and they facilitate that these domestic care workers would come to Pakistan and work there. Again, the contract, the negotiation of pay, their work, you can say timing and everything is decided between the employer and employee. Though they know that if they are not happy with a particular employer, they can ask their agencies to change. But again, like agencies usually, like as we have found in our research, they are like, you should like finish your contract. They try to like negotiate that you just stay in this work and all that. But you can see that there are challenges because it's not regularized and there are no legislations to protect these migrant workers, still like they face these challenges. One exception that we found was that Tanzanian care worker, she has been with the same employer for 17 years and she is in Pakistan. So although there is that agreement that foreign domestic care workers come to Pakistan, would she have the same kind of protection privileges granted to a Filipino care worker? Of course, no. So we need to see that if government recognizes that foreigners are coming for domestic care work, how would you deal with these who are not part of that particular nationality or group? Then we have other sectors. Mostly these consist of semi-skilled, highly skilled and unskilled migrants and refugees. So mostly you could see that Afghan refugees or migrants, they work in these sectors. Just a brief thought. Usually in economic or migration research or discussions, Afghan refugees are unacknowledged, especially their economic contribution. So they have been here for a long time and they are working in these informal sectors, but they are not like protected by the state or their contribution is acknowledged. So they do prefer like working in these like informal sectors because there is a lot of flexibility for women, especially that they negotiate their own like timings, they can travel freely and they do enjoy the like freedom of working on their own and independently. But again, there is no guarantee of protection and pay. There are certain like cases of discrimination as well because they are Afghans and usually Pakistanis are Pakistanis have favorable attitude towards Afghans, but in certain cases they do feel that they are discriminated because they are Afghans and refugees. So the entire narrative is that Afghans are refugees in Pakistan. So you can see that how it impacts their economic engagement and migration and labor contribution in labor market. Generally, we have seen Afghan refugees and migrants in economic participation. There are various NGOs that work specifically with refugees. So they try to like empower them through skills and trainings and all that. But again, it's very restricted to certain sectors. and it's very like semi-skilled kind of work. But as one of our participants shared, that they have been here for a long time and they have lived in Pakistan for so many years, even their kids were born here, they still don't have the same kind of, you can say, legal status of being a citizen. Because of that, they cannot get access to certain economic opportunities. Mostly they work in private or these informal sectors. And even if they are educated in their community schools, the mainstream education institutions, they don't recognize their education. So we can see these kind of discrimination in policies and generally in economic activities that kind of hinder their participation in Pakistan economic labor market. Generally, we see that there are different drivers and motivations to come to Pakistan. It is very interesting that all of our participants, they are like, we didn't know nothing about Pakistan when we came or heard or read very negative reviews on Pakistan, like it's not a safe country, it's not a safe country for women. Despite all that, they come to Pakistan. And it is also interesting to see that all of them, they show that they're very satisfied with their decision to come to Pakistan. And their experiences to live here and work here has been positive generally. But you could see and tell from the data that they are aware about these gendered roles and discrimination and differences. And there is a lot of comparison about like Pakistani women, being a Pakistani woman, as well as being a woman in their own home country. So generally the idea is that in their own countries, women have far better protection as compared to Pakistan. So you see that idea that Pakistan is not safe for these women. So I think it kind of affects how they move in the social, cultural, and urban spaces, because they don't negotiate their presence in these spaces as foreigners, as women. So they would dress in a certain way, they would be aware about like going out to certain places. So you can see these two pictures. This is a paradise picture. One is one of the crowded markets in Islamabad. The other one is located in the most, like you can say, a better neighborhood. So they would prefer to go and hang out in these better neighborhoods because they feel that they won't be, you can say, they won't feel any kind of like issues or discrimination there as compared to these places, because when they go to these places, they are stared at or they get harassed and all that. So you see that negotiation taking place within these urban spaces. So we have this again, like experiences vary. So migrant women who come from North African or East African countries, they feel a lot of discrimination because of their race and ethnicity. As compared to, you can say, Filipino workers, usually they are treated well because people sometimes mistake them for Chinese, and the general perception is that China and Pakistan are friends. So it impacts how they experience and how they live and work in Pakistan. And we have like generally, again, like Pakistan men or people, when women go outside, they do face certain kind of, you can just staring, people catcall and all that. So it is like experienced by almost all of like foreign women working in Pakistan. Generally the experience is nice, but again, if we go through like their data and analyze it well through various lenses, we can see how they negotiate and kind of create that safe space for themselves, because the government or the society does not protect them or guarantee that they will be protected as foreigners or as women in Pakistan. I think they have that understanding there, as well as within the work environment. They know that there are no, you can say, legal protections, or there isn't much they can do beyond their contracts. So they kind of negotiate how they work and exist within this space.
Karen, we're almost out of time.
Thank you.
Ah, perfect.
Sorry.
Okay, so thanks very much, Karen and Shia. Would you like to take the next presentation? And if we could keep the time, because I think we need to leave some time for questions. Thanks very much,
Shia. Yeah, thanks, Eleanor, thanks. Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening if there are people from Australia like me, which is just midnight here. So, hello everybody. I'd just like to share my screen first. Okay, so what I'm about to speak tonight is the labor migrant in Kurdistan region. So first of all, I have to mention that we started this project much later than the cases in Turkey, in Lebanon, in Pakistan. So I can say that whatever I'm presenting is the result of 35 to 40% of the interviews, and the rest is from the literature review that we have collected, and also the interviews that we have done with agencies, recruiting agencies, and also mostly from the governmental agencies like Ministry of Labor and Social Affairs in Kurdistan. So I try to, that's why you will see my presentation a little bit more general than going into the details of the interviewees. Although there are many similarities within the three presentations, and there are also some differences that you might notice within my presentation with the Kurdistan case. So the Kurdist, when I'm saying the Kurdistan, is a unique case, because for those of you who are not in who are not aware of the situation, Kurdistan is not a country, but here we are referring to as a unique case and as a country, because it has all the responsibilities and also the processes for migration that as an independent state could have while getting international migrants. If I want to categorize the main drivers for drivers of the migrants for Kurdistan region, I can say within this three or four of drivers. So before 2003 or before 2005, I can hardly find any cases of labor migrants in Kurdistan from this category that we are referring to as a, especially in service sector or in hospitality sector. So that's why we can say that one of the main drivers for migrants was those granting self-rule or autonomy that Kurdistan region has. And it has been officialized after 2005, and it is a legal entity within the constitution of Iraq. So after that, from 2008, we had an economic booming in Kurdistan, especially in the sectors of hospitality services, that are the two main growing sector from 2008 until 2014, and then to up to now. And then after that, also, we have the advent of international agencies, United Nations agencies related to United Nations, and also the companies, which are mainly the companies that are working in natural resources, oil and gas sector, and then in construction and infrastructure mainly. And the other group of migrants to Kurdistan are related to the international education, like international schools, universities. For example, there are lots of schools in Kurdistan for primary, secondary, and even high school, which are related to the European countries or regional countries like Turkey, like Lebanon, like Sweden, France, and Germany, US, and UK. So that's why we can, as Ezgi and Kiran categorize the migrants, I can also have the same categorization within the two category of skilled migrants and also services. Although personally, I am not really, I don't agree with this categorization, but this is the thing that we got from the ministry and also from the literature, that they have all categorized migrants within this skills and services. So the skill, they refer to those university teachers, lecturers, and people in international NGOs and companies which are working in companies like ExxonMobil, Shell, and those oil and gas and natural resources companies which are active in Kurdistan. And then for services, they have the projects. For project, they mean the people who are working in those companies. For example, someone who is working in ExxonMobil company in Kurdistan, and not as a skilled one, but as a worker. So they refer to them as a project workers or an industry worker. And then the rest are the domestic workers that and the cleaners that might be the topic of the discussion that we have, and also especially this project that are more mainly focused on this group. And within this group, most of them are females with the domestic workers and cleaners. So the countries that are source of migrants, I have divided them also into several categories. So for this one, for when I refer to Kurdish, I mean the countries, the migrants who are going from Turkey, Iran, and Syria, but most of them are Kurdish. So here, they are not categorized as a as labor migrant, because most of them are considered as local. So they're treated as local. I have met many people from Iran, for example, who are working. If we have this category of someone from another country going to another country, they could be a labor migrant, but they have been living there for a while and they are more Iraqi Kurdish than Iranian Kurdish. This is the same for Turkey and for Syria. So this, we have this one category that is also the majority of migrants are from this category. Then people from south of Iraq, the Arab part of Iraq, who are working in Kurdistan. And then from Western country, which are mostly from those skilled category. And then the mixed one that are mostly in services, hospitality, and what we refer to them as housework area. So Eastern European country, they have a majority, India, not a majority, sorry, a considerable number, Indian, Nepalese, Filipinos, Bangladesh, Thailand, and Sri Lanka, Georgia, and Ghana. There are also many other countries there, but they are, since they were not very visible, I just summarize it to this number. So all in all, we have this number. This is the number that I got it from the Ministry of Labor and Social Affairs. But this number is only related to those people, those domestic workers who have been recruited by agencies, for example. And this is a very unique case about Kurdistan. So if you want, if you are a cleaner or if you are a household worker, you can't go and work in Kurdistan on your own. So you should have an agency to get you recruited. And these agencies will report to the Ministry of Social Affairs. So this is the number that we have. So you can see there's an increase from here. So from 2012 until 2014 and 15. And you will see a decline from here. And you can understand that it is the reason, the main reason is the ISIS crisis. So because of, for example, in 2000, if we say the ISIS emerged by the end of 2014, and still in 2015, Kurdistan was not in the serious crisis. But after 2016, we can see a big decline. So from 9,261, it goes to the 5,145 migrants. And then again, in 2019, it seems to be an increase again. So yesterday, I had an interview with an agency CEO, and he was telling me that it is increasing, but we still don't have the number for 2020 and 2021. But what he said was interesting, that from 2019, we only recruit the females. So it seems that we might be having a bigger number of female migrants from 2019 to 2021. So the ministry or the main governmental body that is responsible for domestic workers is the Ministry of Labor and Social Affairs. And they have issued a regulation document that is related to the foreign workers mainly, and we've translated it into English. So there are some points about that that I will read for you. So by domestic workers or housework, they mean the work that is done inside the house, and that is the kind of works that the members of the family can also do themselves. So such as cooking, cleaning. So it should not involve any expertise. Anyone can do this, but because of any reason, so that when they are busy, they will let the other people to work for them. So housework is someone who is doing this who is employed by a housework and doing this housework. The duration of the foreign workers' employment is 1 year and it can be renewed as required. So for most of our cases, the contract has been renewed to 2 years, 3 years, or maybe there are cases we are working more than 5 or 6 years as well. The registered agencies, as I said, are the responsible for foreign workers. They recruit from the day they enter to the region and to the day they leave. So everything about the migrant workers is related to these agencies. So they are the main body. The ministry is just dealing with these agencies. And they are licensed by Ministry of Labor Affairs. So the number is like this. So since 2007, 163 companies or agents, so they refer them to them as companies, but what we hear in for example, I don't know, in New Zealand, we call them recruiting agencies, not companies, maybe for those. So those companies are formally, 163 has been licensed. 32 of these companies are active and working in Erbil, Sulaimani, and Duhok. So this three, so all of the workers are in these three provinces. So whatever we are doing in Kurdistan region is related to these three provinces, not the rest of the Iraq and other parts. So 57 companies have ceased to work because they have not put their assurance money. So by assurance money, that is that the money that they give to the ministry, it's a bond that is a $50,000. And if they breach any responsibilities, if there is any legal cases or any issues with this, so the ministry will confiscate this money, and they will sometimes reimburse the migrants as well. So for example, 11 of these companies are blacklisted. Within the interview that we had with the agencies and also with someone from Ministry of Labor, they mentioned some cases for us that they have fined one agency's $40,000 just because of breaching the regulations and because of mistreating one of these migrants. And this has become more serious since 2018 because there was a case, there were some death cases, some sexual assault cases against some of the females. So that's why the ministry stepped in and are taking much more serious measures than before. So this recruiting agency, they are responsible for their recruitment, training, the residency, health and safety, and departure. So from the day they enter and the day they leave, they have to be responsible for those people who are recruiting. So what the government is doing is, or the advocate groups and syndicates, which are also part of the government, the Ministry of Social Affairs, they have done three steps in protecting migrants. So providing a hotline phone number for emergency cases so they can use this number anytime, anywhere to report any issue that they have faced by their employer or by the agency or by anyone else. And also they provide casual or regular visiting to these people every month and every week sometimes. And now it is even casually, from 2019. And also providing legal advice and assisting with court cases. There have been examples that the ministry and this advocates group, they have provided the free solicitor for migrants just to sue their agencies or to their employers if there has been any mistreatment cases. So there are these issues and these cases and these critics have showed up when we are doing the literature review and also within some of the interviews that we have done. So probably violation is the main one. So we categorize them as a sexual violation. There has been a few cases that is even some case, one of the cases was reported on the Kurdish media in 2000, I think it was 2019 or 18, I don't remember exactly, but there has been some example of sexual harassment and also sexual violation and physical violation, cultural differences and individual rights violation and absence of social assurance. So these are the main cases of violations that has been reported by some of our, not all of our interviews. I think this one or two of them reported some kind of sexual violations by mainly taxi drivers. Then the rest are from the collected data and information that we got from other peoples. Then the other parts of the issues are documentation. Sometimes the agencies confiscate their document, their passport, because their passport is in the hands of the these agencies from the first day that they arrive until the day. So they don't have their own passport. And if they don't comply with their tax and also with their work, their residency will be revoked and their contract will be revoked. So there is no security, no job security within this type of migrants. The other issues are being smuggled to other parts of Iraq. For example, they are getting recruited for Kurdistan only to work in that house, in the house that is being assigned to them. So they can't go and change their employer. By the employer, I mean the house owner. And sometimes agencies, they hand over migrants to each other. So this has been also cases of that were reported by the ministry that this is not legal by the ministry's regulation. And also deception and safety at work, there are other issues that have been reported. So here I want this was a general concepts of the labor migrants in Kurdistan. I want you to have a look at this short video, which is about an ethnic food festival in Kurdistan by the labor migrants, mostly the Asian ones. Can you see the screen now?
If you want to sell online.
No, we can still only see your PowerPoint presentation.
Okay,
sorry.
I have to share that one again. So sorry.
And also to just ask you to wrap up after the video, because we're
yeah, it's the last one. I don't have anything after that. So I have to go and so I stop this one to share another one. Do you have it now?
Loading.
Yes. Go to Wix e-commerce and create a professional.
So she's speaking in Kurdish now. So she and also she's kind of fluent now.
Yeah, please, we are running out of time. We really need to give
Okay, yeah, that's fine. Yeah, that's it. That's all. Okay, that's all. It's done. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. That's all.
Thank you. I'm not sure what we're going to do because we've only got 20 minutes. And if Zeynep could be brief, and I'm not sure I'm going to have a chance to really present at Lebanon in order to have some questions. So if you could be brief. Thanks very much.
Yeah. Sure, no problem. Just let me share my screen. Okay. Is it good now?
Yep.
Okay, I think I need to be very fast and quick. So I am going to talk about migrant domestic and care workers and especially the impacts of COVID-19. I will skip the first two slides that give a general contextual information about Turkey and the care regime. Our study focuses on four dimensions. In which migrant domestic and care workers have been affected by COVID-19. They are loss of employment and changing working conditions, border closure and territorial entrapment, and access to services. Let me introduce the participants. We interviewed 12 women. They are mostly from former Soviet Union countries. The majority age is between 40 to 60. They are educated women with high school degrees and BA degrees in different programs. Mostly work as living caregivers, and besides that, they are daily cleaners and child caregivers. Their occupation status in the country of origin is diverse, from white collar jobs to homemaker, agricultural, and factory workers. Majority has a residence permit. There are only three women with a work permit. Four married women, besides divorced, separate, single, and widow. A majority have children, and this is interesting. Their duration of stay for women in Turkey has generally been long-term. The shortest period of stay is 3.5 years among the interviewees. Let me talk about the loss of employment and changing working conditions. Women working as daily cleaners are hit hard by the pandemic, as they first experienced loss of employment to a large extent, and then their job opportunities really decrease. On the other hand, those working as living mostly keep their jobs, but in changing conditions during the pandemic, there is this burnout issue. The living underlined the increase on their psychological and physical work burden due to increasing number of family members staying at the houses, delicate hygienic measures, and lack of mobility or day off, especially the women who are not allowed to leave the house, talk about they feel burnout. You can see the quotation from a living domestic worker, 23-year-old Turk man. There was a lot of house confinement. There was no problem in grocery shopping, but because they met my needs and brought me anything that I wanted, but there was a lot trouble about taking a day off. I leave every 2 months. I had to leave the house and come back within 24 hours. I used to cry for 2 days to force them to allow me to leave. And it was only on the third day they used to say yes. The second dimension is border closure and territorial entrapment. These women are often unable to return to their country of origin as countries have closed their borders during the pandemic. But very few mention that they desire to return, as they think that the public management of pandemic would be worse in their country of origin. It was the case especially for the Turkmen woman. But on the other hand, this goes hand in hand with the endless worry and anxiety of women for the families left behind during the pandemic. The third dimension is the health issues, access to health services. Women have had insurance, but it's only on the paper, and it doesn't provide any advantage. They mentioned that they need to pay the cost of treatment or medicine themselves. And when women get sick, need medicine, treatment, COVID test, or protective measures for a strong immune system, their needs are either covered by the employers or by themselves. This quotation is a positive quotation because her relation to her employer is a very positive relation. That's why she was taken care of in a good way. But it's not the case for the whole of sample or of the interviewees. Women have coping strategies, but it's safe to say that there are individual-oriented strategies during the pandemic, such as gathering in rented places once in a while to socialize and relax. make use of either migrant network for other job opportunities or related channels for social assistance. Increasing measures for self-protection, like not going outside even if available or taking vitamins during the pandemic, or using social media such as WhatsApp groups to check each other if everyone is safe and well. We also interviewed the Union of Domestic Workers in Istanbul and Antalya, and they underlined the important role the migrant domestic and care workers could play in the collective struggle for better working conditions. Yet the informality, precarity, and the invisibility, as well as rising anti-immigrant and xenophobic atmosphere in Turkey, seems to prevent migrant women from being part of a collective organization. That's why all the strategies they improve are individual-oriented strategies. You can read on the quotation that they check each other through WhatsApp, social media groups, and show solidarity to those who are in difficult situations. So let me summarize. Inferior position of domestic and care work shaped by rudimentary welfare regime and being outside the scope of protective regulations with no control on employers' practices and attitudes appears to continue during the pandemic. Gender inequalities are likely to be made worse by COVID-19 and disproportionately impact migrant women. Our research shows that COVID-19 has deepened and intensified the ongoing vulnerabilities and discriminatory experiences of migrants and care workers, migrant domestic and care workers, differential and unequal impact stratified by immigration status and the relationship between employee and employer. And I just mentioned women have coping strategies, but they are only on individual levels and do not take the form of collective action. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Zeynep, for... for being so succinct. I think that because we haven't got much time left, I just wanted to say a little bit about the Lebanese case study. I don't know if it's worth showing the slides, because maybe, what do you think, Evelyn?
I mean, if you'd like to leave some time for questions.
Yeah, I was just going to give just a few pointers and not show the slides. Okay, so in the Lebanese case, as you know, Lebanon, the literature there is completely dominated by migrant domestic workers. There are a lot of NGOs and local NGOs that are operating in Lebanon around this issue of how do we do something about the kafala system, which has been said to be a form of modern day slavery. And what we have is, there's also what are called freelancers in Lebanon. That is either those who've broken their contracts and left before they've ended, or they stay on without contracts. So the big issue there is this, the question of what can be done about the kafala. Now, Jia talked about the agencies in Lebanon. It's the same thing. The agencies have a huge amount of power. And after the, so in Lebanon, we're not just talking about the issue of migrant domestic workers. We're talking about the collapse of the economy, which means people can't afford to pay them in dollars. And we also had the Beirut explosion, which was another issue. So in this case, the agencies have a lot of power, because post the explosion, there was an attempt to implement a new unified standard contract. The agencies went to the Shura Council and they criticized the law that the Ministry of Labor had tried to introduce. So we're still, as far as I understand, stuck with the kafala system as it is. The other very interesting thing is that we haven't yet interviewed them, but there are a number of very active NGOs such as the anti-racism movement, which is trying to work to combat the issues around kafala, as well as help all racialized minorities in Lebanon. And there is also a Ethiopian group of feminists who've organized again to help Ethiopian women in particular, who are the largest now, the group of domestic workers. The second thing I just want to say before wrapping up is that we interviewed a number of Syrian women. And here what we've seen is that what we've been doing on SIGI has been really instructive, because amongst the Syrian women who were labor migrants, we had two who were entrapped into sex work, who try, because they were desperate to leave intense gender violence in the home and in public. And secondly, we had a transgender and two transgender and one lesbian woman who also left, again, due to severe gender violence, both in the workplace, in public, and in home. And so this is an interesting area here of the combination of groups that we had in Lebanon that we want to follow through. So just to say that I think if to leave time for questions, just want to say that I think you can see the range of situations that we've been studying and the range of sectors and conditions in which we've been exploring in these four countries. And lastly, the significance of the gender discriminatory factors that have pushed a number of women out. And interestingly, the ones that we interviewed in Lebanon had said, particularly LGBTQI, had said many of their friends had gone to Turkey and some of them managed to get to Europe and North America. So just to end it there, so we have time for questions.
Thank you, Eleanor, for this very quick overview, but it's good to hear a little bit at least from the situation in Lebanon as well. So I have three questions gathered from the chat. Two of them are specifically for Ezgi, and then the other one is for anyone of the panel who would like to take it. So Grace Akello, our colleague from the Hub, is asking Ezgi whether there were any foreign female workers in the Turkish health sector that you came across in your study. And a second question came from Dilek Cindolu, who is asking whether you could elaborate about the previous overseas experience of the female migrants and whether their origin, if you know whether they come mostly from big or small cities. And I'll just add the last question to it and then I'll leave it to the panel to decide who'll take it on in the interest of time. It's from Nicola Chanamutu from the University of Lincoln in the UK. And she's asking whether any of the presenters could comment on whether their participants talked about changing jobs from one sector to another, moving from lesser skilled to highly skilled work, or whether this was not really an issue that you've come across. So I'll leave you with the task to decide who's gonna take that one, but we'll start with Ezgi.
Thank you, Evelyn. So the first question is about health sector. Yeah, there are some female workers working at international hospitals like Austrian, German, or French, or Italian hospitals. There are a lot of doctors. And there are also Syrian doctors working in Turkish hospitals. But we couldn't come to that point. We couldn't access them due to the pandemic. They were extremely busy with patients. And for our own safety, we couldn't go to hospitals during this period. And for the other question, Dilek Hocam asked me if we know about their experiences, overseas experiences. I'll just briefly show the map again. So I know where they came from. Some of them are coming from small cities like Maine or another small city in California, but some of them are coming from global cities like New York or Los Angeles. But most of them had precarious jobs, like they had to work in different jobs at the same time, like they were nannies, bartenders, waitresses, but at the same time trying to continue their professions. And some of them, for the UK or France, the one coming from France is coming from Paris, who had a PhD in architecture. Another coming from the UK was coming from a small city, relatively small city. She was doing her job, but she became a full-time professor here. So yeah, that's all I know, but if we can continue, I can give more details.
Thanks, Ezgi. Maybe GR Zeynep or
Yes, regarding Nicola's question, I think in high-skilled categories, yes, the changing jobs is pretty normal. We within this, the cases, I think two of our interviews out of 11, they mentioned that they have changed from one NGO to another, and then from one sector to even another sector. But within the other sector, within the labor market, within the services, we haven't had any noticeable changes in the sector. There has been something, I think one case is from some admin.
One case, the Filipino woman precisely had started off as a domestic and had moved into administration.
Yes, that one from admin to, was one of them.
Can I just say about the health sector? I think there's a combination probably of the pandemic making it very difficult, but quite a lot of health sectors are highly regulated. So for example, in Lebanon, it would be very difficult. I raised this with Chabelle about trying to get nurses, who said you cannot, you know, you wouldn't get them. It's not like the GCC countries where they're employing very large numbers of foreign health workers. So I think it's a combination of the pandemic and that these can be highly regulated sectors in which foreign labor may find it difficult to get jobs.
All right, thank you so much. I mean, maybe I don't know if I'm supposed to wrap it up or if someone else is supposed to wrap it up. Eleanor, do you want to have the last word and conclude the session?
I do apologize for all the difficulties. I've never had it as bad with my Zoom just going all the time. So I just want to thank all the audience for being here and hope that it's been insightful. And also thank the speakers for the insightful comments that they've made about our four case studies. And as I say, these are preliminary results, and we will be publishing the results of our endeavors, you could say, and hopefully contributing, and I think this is very important, to really be centering the research on the South, but so that it's not subordinate and it plays a part in an overall view. And I think lastly, my question is, how does it fit into some of the theoretical frameworks that we are using within gendered labor migration, which we haven't really gone into, but that's the next step. Thank you very much for everyone, for participants and presenters.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks for stepping in and saving the day. Many thanks.
No, it's so interesting to hear from all of you. Thank you and take care.
Thank you, bye.